This is a story of who we were, how we got here.
Houston, the Eagle has landed.
Roger, 20. Tranquility, we come.
And where we are going.
You've got mail.
So join us as we take history off the page.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of History Off the Page. This is our fifth installment in our special series on the history of Israel and Palestine. And in today's episode, we're going to talk about the Arab Revolt of 1936 to 1939. For those of you that are joining us for the first time, previous episodes in this series have covered the development of Zionism at the end of the 19th century, the emergence of a distinct Palestinian identity around the same time, the impact of the Great War, and then in our last episode, we examined the construction of the British Mandate. We also have a more reflective episode on popular and academic approaches to Israeli and Palestinian history, where I laid out some of my frustrations with some of the more, shall we say, popular theories used to analyze the situation today. If you want to learn more about these episodes, or episodes that we have in our series, which usually concentrates on modern European history, check out our website at www.historyoffthepage.com. Now, as I said, today we're going to be talking about the Arab Revolt, which is really one of the most important events in the history of the conflict. It's certainly an event that does not get enough coverage. People talk about, obviously, the 47-48, the UN partition, the war that follows, the Arab-Israeli war that follows, wars in 56, 67, 73. But really, the Arab Revolt, as I said, is one of the most fundamentally important, at least talked about, moments in the history of the conflict. Because basically, it marks the first time that one side attempted to use systemic violence to solve the big political question about what was going to happen with the future of the territory. Now, as we've talked about, the idea of violence in the Middle East in general, but specifically in Palestine, is not necessarily new. Right? We saw this already in some of our previous episodes. We talked about local skirmishes that happened in the 1890s and the early 1900s before World War I. We talked about the considerable amount of violence that the Ottoman Empire did to both the Arab and Jewish populations of Palestine during the First World War. We talked about a number of these riots that occurred during the 1920s, like the Wailing Wall riot. But for the most part, these are relatively spontaneous demonstrations. Order tends to be restored relatively quickly. It might take a day or two to kind of clean everything up. But in general, it's not systemic. It's not massive. These are isolated moments of violence. Also, the consequences of these initial revolts, right? They heighten tensions between the two communities, Arab versus Zionist or Jewish. But for the most part, whether we're talking about casualty figures, whether we're talking about the kind of economic impact or the political impact of these events, these are relatively small. You're talking about maybe a couple dozen people that die in the most extreme examples of violence before 1936. But the Arab Revolt is going to be on a different scale entirely. In fact, it's probably better to think about it, if you're trying to make historical analogies, as something that is much closer to a modern insurgency or guerrilla warfare, something like the Vietnam War, especially in the early days before the North Vietnamese Army really becomes heavily involved in it, right? It's the Viet Cong fighting against the United States and the South Vietnamese. Think about something like Algeria in the initial phases of the uprising, 1954, the FLN. Think about a more modern example like Iraq and Afghanistan in the early 2000s with the insurgencies there. The Arab Revolt is not just a revolt in the sense of people spontaneously demonstrating and, okay, then it goes away. It is a mass uprising that will last basically for about 3 years. It involves the creation of formal networks and organizations that are designed to support and facilitate both violence and, as we'll see in a moment, a strike. Basically, how the revolt begins is with an economic strike, something more closer to India, perhaps. But this is a really big deal, and that's why we're taking a single episode to focus on it. I'll also add that it's very appropriate to understand this moment, this event, as an example of anti-colonial violence. This is an uprising of kind of quote-unquote natives against the imperialists. Now, those imperialists are not the Jews, they're the British, just to be clear. In the British, just as in other cases where we have anti-colonial resistance movements, insurrections, violence, revolts, mutinies, whatever you want to call it, this violence is met with a brutal crackdown again by the imperial power, which is the British. And we'll go into some more detail about this once we flesh out the episode. But the British response to the revolt in Palestine was every bit as awful as they were in other places. Finally, the last thing that we want to note before we begin is that the importance of the revolt lies less in it being the first of something than it does for the effect that it had on the local Palestinian population. Basically, for reasons that we'll go into later in the episode, the Arab revolt actually does tremendous damage not to the British, not to the Zionists, but to the Palestinians themselves. And it's not only because of the British reaction, harsh as it is. There is, as we'll see, kind of a civil war going on between Palestinian factions within the broader context of the Arab revolt. Thousands of Palestinians will die during the revolt, not just at the hands of the British, but thousands of Palestinians will die because of Palestinian-on-Palestinian violence. The Arab revolt also drives tens of thousands of Palestinians out of the country and drives even more out of important sectors of the economy. Zionists, or the Jews in Palestine, the yishuv, the Jewish community living in Palestine, will benefit greatly from these actions. And so the meaning of the events of the Arab revolt is not just, well, it was an insurgency. Oh, well, this is the first systemic use of violence. The real significance of the Arab revolt is that it is going to kind of line the playing field, if you will, for the partition and the subsequent wars that happen in 1947-48. The Palestinian or Arab side in Palestine will be devastated by the effects of the Arab revolt, and they will not have recovered in time before the partition happens in 1947-48. This is also probably a good time to mention that the Arab revolt is a tremendous historical lesson about the consequences of using violence. I think if you look back in history, there are obviously a number of groups that romanticize the idea of violence, that kind of focus on the idea of using violence to achieve political ends. Certainly, this is very true in the region today. If you look at a group like Hamas, Hamas celebrates violence. They celebrate the idea of what they would term anti-colonial violence. Right? How do we get our land back? Of course, it's by kicking out the occupiers, right? We take matters into our own hands. This isn't unique to Hamas, right? You find this in many different contexts, many different groups thinking about the virtuous use of violence as a means of resistance, right? We could talk about the French resistance. We could talk about the Polish resistance, right? There's a whole museum in Warsaw dedicated to the notion of resistance. People tend to celebrate violence because they think that it is an effective tool for achieving your ends. To put this another way, violence or the use of violence is a means of control, is a way that people who seem to not have power can take control of a situation and achieve whatever outcome they think that they want it to be. However, we need to recognize that historically, not every time you use violence, right? There are some cases where not only is violence legitimate, but it's kind of a last resort. It's necessary. Obviously, you talk about an invading army, resisting that army, talk about partisan actions, right? There are times that violence is successful and a key part of playing out warfare. But it's also worth noting that sometimes the use of violence gives us an illusion of control. In this context, in Israel-Palestine, you could argue that both parties, to some extent, believe in this idea that just for a little bit more use of violence, we can seize our own destiny, we can take control of the situation, we can achieve whatever our political ends are or the desired outcome that we want. What the Arab Revolt reveals is that violence sometimes, perhaps even often, does not achieve its goals. That especially when you talk about anti-colonial violence, it's not just an easy process of, well, we resisted, we never gave up, we fought the invaders, they drove them out of the country. But there is a dangerous tendency of this violence to boomerang back on the population in whose name we are trying to revolt or we are trying to seek independence. If you are trying to write the history of Palestine and understand why today there is no independent Palestine, a huge part of that process was the decision to launch the Arab Revolt, was the decision to sustain the Arab Revolt, was the way that it was fought. And in the end, the Arab Revolt is not some glorious moment from the past. It is, as I said, it's one of the key moments as to why you don't have a Palestine today. It does tremendous damage to the goal of Palestinian nationalism. And I don't want to give away too much about where we're going in this series, but I can tell you that there are a number of other more recent events that fit into this same category. One of the big ones is the Second Intifada. People that look at the West Bank today and are critical of a lot of the Israeli policies there, and it's totally fine to be critical of them. One of the things that often gets left out is why those policies exist or how Israelis justify those policies. And they all go back to, or many of them go back to, the Second Intifada, which didn't achieve a whole lot and actually brought a lot of misery to the Palestinian cause. All right, I'm starting to get ahead of myself, so let's get back into the 1930s and kind of set the background context a little more for the Arab Revolt. When we last left off, we had seen rising tensions between local Jewish and Arab communities in Palestine. And we saw how this was in some ways a product of their increasing mutual strengths and developments. And we talked about a lot of this in depth in our last episode on the British Mandate. By the early 1930s, the Zionist community of Palestine had grown quite strong, forming independent institutions such as the Haganah, which, for those of you that didn't listen to that episode, the Haganah is basically like a Jewish defense force, kind of like a militia, and the Histadrut, which again, for those of you that didn't catch the previous episode, is kind of like a Jewish national union. They're involved in labor, but they also start then taking over certain parts of the economy, running it through the benefit of Jews. These institutions essentially carry out state functions related to defense and economics. And again, they do so not in the name of the broader community of people living in Palestine, but they do it on behalf of the Yishuv, or the Jewish community of Palestine. Now, at the same time, we also saw that the Palestinian side, or the Arab side if you prefer, was also growing in terms of economic prosperity. We talked about the development of separate Palestinian political institutions, political parties. Perhaps one of the most important factors going on here, too, is that we really start to see in the 1930s a much sharper focus on Palestinian as opposed to Arab identity. In other words, again, not to spend too much time on this because we've talked about it a lot in the early episodes of the podcast. Basically, in the 1920s and before, there is a tension between the idea of being Arab and the idea of being Palestinian. You're kind of both, but if you can achieve your political goals within a larger Arab community, within being part of, for say, a greater Syria, then you're totally fine with that. And so there's these kind of like dual hats that Palestinians wear, and at times it's not clear what should be the political direction in order to achieve independence. By the time you get to the 1930s, it's pretty clear that what people want to see is an independent Palestine, right? This relationship starts to get flushed out in much more clear and definite ways. So as the 1920s turn to the 1930s, you have increasing incidents of violence between the two communities experienced in major events like the Wailing Wall riots or on a smaller everyday scale. Think about the kind of idea of reprisal raids. We talked about this a little bit. Some of the Jewish defense organizations will perceive that they are attacked. They will respond by attacking local Arab communities. local Arab communities attack the Jewish communities, and it goes back and forth, right? We're not talking about murders necessarily, but we're talking about things like property damage, theft, vandalism. You know, if you think about some of these communities where tensions are very tight, think about something like Northern Ireland before the eruption of violence, day to day, there's lots of little, I wouldn't call them microaggressions because they're really formal aggressions, but there's a lot of stepping on toes. There's little acts of violence between the communities that kind of drive people apart. So Palestine by 1936 is an area that has high tensions between the various ethnic communities. Now, we're going to add to this problems introduced by Europeans and especially the rise of the Nazi Party in Germany after January of 1933. Basically, the Nazi Party is not only explicitly anti-Semitic and anti-Jewish, right? But the Nazis are also anti-Versailles. The Nazis are also trying to revise the post-war peace settlement that ended the First World War. And so, of course, the main obstacles to doing that are Britain and France. And so the Germans are going to look for any way that they can try to undermine the British Empire, and its imperial interests, of course, are a big way to do that. So there's kind of a natural direction for Nazi foreign policy here. They can reach out to Arabs, and in particular, Arabs and Palestinians who feel hostile to Zionism, who are upset about it, who want the Jews out of their country, or at least the Jews that weren't already there out of the country. And so the Nazis actually begin to export anti-Semitism, or perhaps better put, anti-Judaism, because anti-Semitism Arabs are Semites. But they start exporting anti-Semitism to the Middle East. And one of the ways that they do this, they realize very early on, well, we can't really sell Mein Kampf to the Arab population because Mein Kampf is, in addition to being anti-Jewish, Mein Kampf is also very much about race, and Arabs are seen as very similar to Jews, racially speaking, in the Nazi kind of imagination. So they're going to have to kind of change what they're selling. And so the anti-Semitism that they sell is not only the kind of stereotypes that are unfortunately still with us today about Jews being greedy, Jews being powerful, Jews being manipulative and controlling the press and the media and destroying healthy civilizations for their own benefit, but they also begin to rework anti-Semitism into a religious narrative. They begin to highlight certain episodes from Arab history as a way of kind of saying, look, the trouble with Jews didn't start in the 1880s or 1890s with Zionism. The trouble with Jews goes all the way back to the prophet, to the early days when he was in Mecca and he was preaching, and basically he had some conflicts with some local Jewish merchants there. So the Nazis begin to export and promote, again, anti-Semitism or anti-Judaism in the region, developing contacts with Palestinian nationalists in ways that become very important, as we'll see in a little bit. Now, not all of this is just clandestine and through the foreign ministry. The Nazis will create German-backed Arabic newspapers and journals. They will found new institutes for Middle Eastern studies. And perhaps most importantly, after 1938, they will found an Arabic language radio program that they broadcast through their radio transmitter at Zazen. And certainly the Italians also do some of this. The Germans are much more involved in it, but the Italians also start trying to circulate anti-British propaganda, both with the common goal of kind of undermining the British Empire and opening up space for what the Italians imagine will be their conquest of the Middle East. Now, at the same time that this is going on, however, the Nazis are, again, pushing anti-Semitism, anti-Judaism in the Middle East. The Nazis also, kind of inadvertently, increase enthusiasm for Zionism. One of the things that the Germans are trying to do before 1938-39 is not kill all the Jews, but they want all the Jews to leave. They want to expel the Jews. And so they come up with all these regulations. They kick Jews out of various positions in society. They try to encourage emigration. Now, as Jews living in other parts of the world see what's going on in Nazi Germany, which again, just a few years before this, this is Weimar Germany. This is the outsider is insider, to use Peter Gay's famous phrasing of it. This is a culture where there's a lot of diversity, a lot of experimentation, a lot of cosmopolitanism. Jews are not only sort of tolerated, but are accepted as equals, are prospering, are playing some of the leading roles economically and politically. And all of a sudden, that situation just totally reverses itself. So for many Jews living in places like the United States or Britain or Canada, the Zionist argument that, hey, you guys are never going to be treated as equals, you're never really going to be seen as an American or as British or as South African or whatever, that suddenly seems to be a much more compelling argument after what the Nazis have done. Now, again, the Nazi policy before 1939 is mainly to drive most, if not all, of the country's 500,000 Jews away to get them to emigrate. But this project runs into a huge problem, which is that virtually no other countries in the world want to allow Jewish refugees to come. The Nazis take power in the middle of the Great Depression. Countries are struggling economically. Why on earth would you want to bring in some more competition for labor when your unemployment rate is already at 10, 20, 30%? Why on earth would you want to bring in old people or poor people who are going to consume resources? So as the Nazis are trying to kick out all the Jews from Germany, they run into things like American immigration policy. The United States before World War II does not have a category for people who are refugees. There is no sort of auxiliary way of emigrating. You have to go through the main system, and the main system has a series of quotas for the number of people that can emigrate from any particular country. In Germany, that number is 25,000 people, or I should say four Germans. So 25,000 Germans can emigrate to the United States or immigrate into the United States each year. Now, that's not Jews that can immigrate. That is Germans total. So think about all the people that had relatives in Milwaukee or Chicago, right? They're from Germany. They want to emigrate. All those people need to apply for a visa to come to those cities. Jews don't get any sort of preferential treatment. Nobody says, oh, well, you know, the Jews are being persecuted. We should let them in. So basically, these Jews living in Germany don't really have anywhere to go at the same time that they're being driven out. This makes a very strong and compelling case for the establishment of a Jewish national home where, theoretically, if this ever happens again, those Jews can go. So Nazi policy, at the same time that they are pushing and encouraging hostility to Jewish migration, will actually accelerate it into Palestine. In fact, the Nazis don't just pay lip service to this. They actually sign an agreement in August of 1933 with several Zionist organizations in Germany and Palestine, including the Anglo-Palestine Bank. This is known as the Havara Agreement. And basically, it essentially allowed Jews to buy German goods that could be exported to Palestine where they could be sold to recoup the money. Now, again, to set the context, this is 1933. Germany is still stuck in the depths of the Great Depression. German companies are trying to find export markets. There's a lot of boycotts that happen once the Nazis take power. And so this actually becomes a kind of win-win situation. These Jews that are not allowed to go to Palestine or not supposed to go to Palestine, what do? Well, they buy these goods and they say, oh, I'm going to be a businessman. I'm a businessman and I'm going to sell these goods in Palestine. I'm not looking to permanently emigrate, but I do have to stay in Palestine for a while to sell the goods that I bought to send there, wink, wink. And so you should give me a business visa. And so basically, that's one of the things that they do. They are able to get 60,000 German Jews into Palestine before 1939, just based on this kind of idea of the Havara Agreement. Before 1940, one of the main Nazis involved in kind of the logistics of the Holocaust, or later he'll be involved in logistics of the Holocaust, He's selected because he's supposed to be some sort of expert on Jews, but we're talking here about Adolf Eichmann. Eichmann has very cordial relations with local Zionists. Eichmann is interested in helping them achieve their goal of getting the Jews out of Germany and getting them to Palestine. And so again, what you have here is Nazi Germany both kind of encouraging emigration to Palestine at the same time as they're encouraging resistance to emigration among the local Arab population. Now, just to put some numbers on this group, which are commonly referred to as the Fifth Aliyah, these are the Jews that arrive in Palestine between 1929 and 1939. We're talking here about 200,000 to 300,000 people, all told. This is a substantial increase over previous waves of Jews that have come to the country. Remember, when the first Aliyot start around 1880, the Jewish community of Palestine is measured in the tens of thousands. This is about 10 times that number. Now, the refugees don't come in a sort of sustained wave over the course of 10 years. Sometimes it's more, sometimes it's less, depending on global events going on. And the period of 1938-39 after Kristallnacht, of course, becomes a kind of high watermark of Jewish emigration to Palestine. Now, in Palestine itself, however, the increasing Jewish migration is met with considerable hostility. It creates fear and anxiety among the Arab population that they are going to become a minority. You also, of course, have the voices of the Zionist leaders themselves talking about this idea of creating an independent Israeli state. So this is going to provoke a lot of hostility, a lot of anxiety about what's going to happen. Now, in truth, the Jewish population has gone up. It grew from a low of about 6% after the disruptions of World War I, which also included expulsions, if you'll recall. By the time you get to the mid to late 1920s, it's about 18% of the population. And after this massive influx culminating in 1938-39, it gets to be about 30%. Now, some of you will look at that and say, wow, 30%, that's huge. Like, we can totally see why people are afraid, right? It keeps rising. We keep taking more land, more territory, more people. Others can look at that and say, well, 30%, that's not that much. I mean, it's still a clear minority. It's a significant minority, to be sure, but it's a minority. But either way, it's easy to understand how people could project this future inversion, again, of ethnic relations. And it's easy to see why people got upset about it. You know, another kind of factor that I think a lot of Arabs were thinking about is you have the Haganah. The Haganah in the 1930s is illegally arming itself. The Haganah is stockpiling weapons. Why are you stockpiling weapons if you want to live peacefully together? Now, the Haganah would say, well, we can't trust the British to defend us. We saw what happened with these various riots in the 1920s and early 30s. We have to defend ourselves. But to the local Arabs, it looks like you are arming for insurrection. You are arming to try to seize power. So it's in this backdrop that in Jaffa in October of 1935, one of these illegal arms shipments meant for the Haganah is actually discovered. Authorities confiscate 800 rifles and 400,000 rounds of ammunition. We've moved past the Hashomer, with the night watchman, right? The guy's riding around on a single horse and he's got his, you know, one gun, and we're well past that, right? The Haganah is, by the 1930s, a powerful kind of rising military militia. And so as a result, into the mid-1930s, Palestinian newspapers, intellectuals, politicians, they increasingly see their relationship with their Jewish neighbors as part of a zero-sum game for political control of the territory of Palestine. Now, the Haganah is not the only group that is arming itself. At roughly the same time, the Arabs also have several small militias that they start, including organizations like the Green Hand or the Organization for Holy Struggle. Perhaps one of the most important of these groups is called the Black Hand, led by a Syrian sheikh or kind of preacher named Izz ad-Din al-Qassam. Now, Al-Qassam had participated in efforts to resist the French Caesar of Syria in 1920. He had actually earned himself a death sentence in Syria. So he flees south to Haifa, which isn't too far away. And he soon becomes popular by calling for jihad against the local European colonial powers. France in Syria and Lebanon, Britain in Palestine. Like the Istiklal Party that we discussed in the episode on the British Mandate, Al-Qassam is also very critical of existing Palestinian elites. He sees them as basically being sellouts. Why are you fighting for the scraps from the British table? Why aren't you with the people fighting for the destiny and the independence and the glory of the nation? Now, there's areas where Al-Qassam is very different from Istiklal, and probably the most important is that, unlike Istiklal, which is secular, Al-Qassam sees a return to Islamic orthodoxy as the best path forward for liberation. Al-Qassam further tried to combine this emphasis on Islam, not just with the five pillars, not just with Hajj and charity and praying to Mecca and things like that, but also with the notion of violence, or as he would have put it, anti-colonial violence. He's not the one that comes up with the idea that jihad is the sixth pillar of Islam. That comes later. It's a different guy, Egyptian. But some of the basic ideas are there. He preaches to his followers that, quote, you are a nation of rabbits who are afraid of death and scaffolds and engaged in prattle. You must know nothing that will save us but our arms. Now, there's a problem here, because if you're talking about the idea of armed conflict, especially with Zionists, the Zionists don't have an official army. It's hard to set up, you know, a date where, oh, okay, now we're going to go fight with the Haganah. It doesn't really work like that. Well, you've got people on kibbutzes. What if you attack someone on a kibbutz? What if you attack someone in a village? But the problem is that's murder under Islamic law. You can't just kill people. So how do we get around that? Well, Al-Qassam goes to the Mufti of Damascus, who's not the same guy, Haj Amin, who's the Mufti of Jerusalem that we'll talk about a lot during today's episode. This is a different guy. But basically he goes to a Mufti who's kind of like an Islamic jurist, and he gets a decree that says, you are attacking these settlers, you're attacking these colonial agents. That's not murder, that is resistance. This is a form of jihad, is basically what the Al-Qassam is authorized to carry out. And so he's able to put together a kind of a vision or an ideology in which resistance becomes a core duty of the faith. What does it mean to be Muslim? It means to resist the oppression of your fellow brothers and sisters through violence if necessary. Now, some of you that pay attention to contemporary events are probably thinking, wow, this sounds an awful lot like Hamas. And of course, this is not an accident. In many ways, one could argue that Al-Qassam was actually the spiritual founder of Hamas, even if in a technical sense that only comes into being in 1988. The military wing of Hamas today is literally referred to as the Al-Qassam Brigades in honor of this Al-Qassam from basically the Arab Revolt, or right before the Arab Revolt. And why is this? Well, because, again, Al-Qassam articulates, in some ways for the first time, a specifically Palestinian populist nationalist message that expresses frustration not only with Jews and Zionists and with the British, but especially with local notables who he felt had failed to represent the wishes of the Palestinian people. Now, again, I have to step aside here and make another comment again about this idea of anti-colonial resistance, because, again, it gets romanticized in a way that hides very important distinctions. And one of the biggest things it hides is the idea of how most people feel. I don't know if we want to say the majority of Arabs, but certainly there was a significant and large segment of the Arab population that was not attracted to resistance. As we'll see, they didn't want to participate in a revolt. They didn't necessarily have a problem with the Jewish community, or they felt like these problems could be worked out peacefully. But populism has this way of invoking the image of the people, right? Who are we fighting for? We're fighting on behalf of the people. And when we construct this image of the people, we have a tendency to read out actual people, right? We can read out people that have a different point of view. Populism is also attractive because it frames the actions of individuals as being part of a broader moral framework. The actions that you're taking, your resistance, isn't just about the land that you have or the taxes you have to pay. It's hard to define as some kind of petty personal gripe. Populism redefines these things in broader moral terms so that you're fighting on behalf of the community. You're fighting on behalf of others. The things that you're trying to do are not about you. It's about something broader and bigger and historical, something more meaningful and consequential. And this is just as true today as it was in Palestine in the 1930s. Now, Al-Qassam, while he gained some popularity, some notoriety, he's not the main leader of the Palestinian community in the 1930s, but he gathers a significant enough following that he's able to develop a number of loose cells around the Haifa area. And after the discovery of the arms that we mentioned a few moments ago in the fall of 1935, Al-Qassam basically says, enough is enough. He takes to the hills and begins a program of what he would term active resistance. Now, in terms of scale, this resistance is quite small. The biggest kind of worst thing that they do is they manage to assassinate a Jewish police officer. He's a Jewish police officer, but he's working for Britain, just to be clear. The British, seeing a threat to law, a challenge to law enforcement, thinking about some of the other problems that have gone on, they decide we have to react to this. We have to suppress any chance of more riots like the 1920s or 1930s. To deal with Qassam, they set up an ambush and they successfully kill him in November 1935. But as is often the case, killing the leader of the movement doesn't make it go away. It actually makes it stronger. Al-Qassam becomes a martyr for Palestinian nationalism. And of course, today his legacy is kind of still with us through Hamas. Again, another thing to throw out here, I've talked in many ways about how there's kind of these interesting parallels, or in some ways the Jewish experience and the Arab experience, there's kind of mirror images of each other. We saw this on the Zionist side. We saw how the death of Joseph Trumpeldor created more enthusiasm for Zionism, created more interest in it. Well, the killing of Al-Qassam has kind of the same effect. And so basically, this will help inspire the Arab revolt just a couple months later. Now, before we get into the heart of the revolt, we want to make a kind of clarification here, which is that basically it's going to play out in two phases, or you could even argue three phases with two of them kind of mostly overlapping. The revolt will begin as part of a nationwide strike, and I'll talk about that more in just a second. For the most part, the strike is nonviolent. The people going on strike are not interested in violence. This looks much more like, again, India under the resistance led by Mahatma Gandhi than it does Algeria and the FLN. However, there is, during this initial first couple months of the rebellion, there is a number of people who will form armed units, who will follow, like Al-Qassam, they'll go into the hills, they'll organize. And so there is a little bit of fighting that goes on as well. We'll talk about this again later, but basically in 1937, there is a murder of a British official, and this kind of kicks off the second half, if you will, the second phase of the Arab revolt, and this will be violent. This will be the classic insurgent story. Okay, let's get back, though, first and talk about the general strike. The immediate spark that lights the fire for this revolt was ironically an incident of Arab-on-Jewish violence as opposed to the other way around. And it's actually linked to the killing of Al-Qassam. On April 15th, 1936, two of Al-Qassam's former followers stop a Jewish convoy of cars on the Nablus-Tulkarm Road. They demand to know who's Jewish. They take their money. They tell them that they're stealing their money basically not out of greed, but because they want to arm themselves against Jews. They also frame it as being revenge for the death of Al-Qassam. They then proceed to shoot three of the Jews present, fatally wounding two of them, Zvi Dannenberg and Israel Chazan. The following day, two local Jews, most likely members of the Etzel, which was kind of like a Jewish paramilitary organization, the Etzel shoots and kills two Arabs, Hassan Abu Ras and Salim al-Masri, on the highway to Petah Tikva. These two Arab men had nothing to do with the shooting of the two Jews on the highway. But as often happens, the people that are nationalists, the people that feel strongest about this, they conceive of these sufferings in terms of national groups. And they say, you killed two of ours, we're going to kill two of yours. On the 17th, Chazan's funeral takes place in Tel Aviv, where mourners learn during the funeral procession that Dannenberg also was mortally wounded and was, in fact, dying. As a result, members of the procession announced a march to Jaffa to attack local Arabs. Which, again, this is a good point to make one of these kind of historical notes here that are kind of more broadly true, not just in the Palestine-Israeli context, but more globally. Notice the way that violence is working here to carry out a political function. Not just necessarily killing people, but in terms of mobilizing and motivating them and convincing them that the way that they should understand their relationship with their neighbor is through ethnic terms. That there is a line between us and them, and it's not just a small line between communities or you do things a little bit differently than we do, that this is a hugely important thing and politics needs to be based on it. The people who murdered Dannenberg and Chazan, the people who murdered Abu Ras and al-Masri, are not the ones who had to pay the price for the reciprocal violence. When you think about vengeance, the vengeance theoretically should be directed at the people who did the violence in the first place. But that's hard. That's law enforcement. That's tracking them down. There's an investigation. You know, it's really difficult. And so all too often what happens is that groups who understand these as group-on-group violence rather than individual-on-individual violence, they will find two innocents, two people that are easier to kill, soft targets in today's parlance, and they will affect violence on them. But the people on the receiving end of that violence, Jewish, Arab, other, they don't understand what's happened to them or to their loved ones as, well, we killed two of theirs, so therefore they were justified in killing two of ours, and now we're even. They understand it as, wow, these guys just came and killed two of our people. They understand it as an act of injustice, not justice. And so one group's act of vengeance becomes the other's act of grievance, which then in turn calls for reciprocal vengeance. Over the course of time, you drive hostility between the two groups through violence, and it becomes kind of cyclical. Violence becomes a way of policing and opening and convincing people of the chasm between groups. In the case of this particular incident, 3 days of rioting followed, in which several Jews die, and the British decide that they are going to take more aggressive measures to install calm. Now, in response to these attacks and to the deteriorating situation more generally, on April 19, 1936, local Palestinians announced the beginning of a nationwide strike against the British Mandate and against Jewish immigration. Now, the strike was not pre-planned, but arose totally organically and actually took many of the most prominent Palestinian Arab leaders completely by surprise. The most important of these leaders was a guy named Haj Amin, the Mufti of Jerusalem. We've mentioned him a couple times. Haj Amin is very jealous, I guess, of the idea that other people are going to play a key role in this process. He's very territorial in some ways. And so he basically backs a plan to form a national committee that can help organize and supervise this sporadic resistant effort. The idea is basically to give them some coordination, to have a sort of political institution that can speak on behalf of the Arab people or behalf of the Palestinian people. And many of the other Palestinian leaders agree with him. Right? This is a good way to kind of get control of what's going on, to direct it, to make it more useful. On April 25th, Haj Amin helps found the Arab Higher Committee, which was comprised of the leaders of the most prominent members of the Palestinian society, prominent clans, political parties, etc. This includes Khagib Nashashibi, a leading member of the National Defense Party. The National Defense Party is basically the al-Nashashibi's kind of main political group. It includes Jamal al-Husseini, who is a leading member of the Palestine Arab Party, which is the Husseini's equivalent. Again, for those of you that missed our previous episode, the Nashashibis and the Husseinis were the two leading families in sort of in terms of Palestinian politics. They had a very strong rivalry with each other, constantly fighting. And this is one of the reasons that Palestinians had trouble sort of speaking with a singular voice throughout the events that we're talking about today. Initially, the Arab Higher Committee also includes Onwi Abd al-Hadi, the leader of Istiqlal, and several other, again, major national figures and parties. Haj Amin took the position as the chairman of the Arab Higher Committee and became kind of in many ways the voice of the Palestinian people during this Arab revolt. On May 15th, a couple weeks later, the Arab Higher Committee formally endorsed the strike. They issue a list of formal demands that includes the end of Jewish immigration, prohibition on land sales from Arabs to Jews, and the establishment of a national Palestinian government. Later on, they will also add to this list the idea that Palestinians should not pay taxes to the mandate. Now, this strike has mixed results in terms of its effectiveness. On the one hand, it marked a significant step in the development of Palestinian political institutions. It moves the debate over the region's future beyond the control of the notables, at least temporarily. It was one of the first expressions of widespread populism and nationalism. It intertwines the two and expresses the idea of Palestinian identity at a national level in a way that had previously not been on display before. So there were some benefits to the strike. On the other hand, however, the strike proves to be incredibly ineffective. It doesn't come off like similar efforts in places like India or even the American South. Right, where things like the Montgomery bus boycott, that has meaning, that does change things. It does create or force change. Instead, rather than significantly impacting the British colonial authorities, the principal victims of the boycott actually turned out to be the Arab population of Palestine. Now, there's a couple reasons for this, or there's a couple ways we might say that the strike was felt. First, while the intention was to harm British economic interests, there are quite a few Arabs who never participate in the strike to begin with. And this is especially true in key areas such as shipping, the civil service, and to some extent the citrus markets. One of the most important places that feels the actual weight of the strike in 1936 is the Arab-dominated port at Jaffa. The problem is that Jaffa is not the only port in Palestine. In fact, a little ways to the north, there is a large city called Haifa, which just happened to complete a deep water port in 1933. It just happens to be directly connected to the rail lines. And so when those Arab dock workers go on strike in Jaffa, it's easy for companies, it's easy for the British mandate itself, the British authority, to shift the focus of shipping just to the north to Haifa, instead of curtailing British tax revenues that are used to fund the mandate government, the long-term effect was the elevation of the ethnically mixed Haifa over the Arab-dominated Jaffa. In addition, as I mentioned, there are quite a few Arabs that are not on board with or do not support or are not willing to sacrifice for the boycott. Many Arabs continue to pay some form of taxes during the period. And even if they didn't, the Arabs are not the only people in Palestine providing tax revenue. That 30% that happens to be Jewish in 1939, they actually pay 58% of the taxes in the region. Jews in Palestine do not go on strike. Jews in Palestine do not stop paying taxes. And so the ability of the Palestinians to use economics as a weapon is somewhat limited. Another problem is you're going on strike, but this isn't happening in a vacuum. This is happening against the backdrop of hundreds of thousands of refugees coming into Palestine from Germany. You are going on strike at a moment when the labor market is witnessing this massive influx of workers who are desperate for a job. I mentioned before that immigration usually doesn't lead to economic hardship for the kind of native population. Usually immigration is a benefit to everybody. But this was not the case in Palestine in 1936. Think about another market deeply affected by this, right? This is Palestine. It's not really industrialized yet. You have a very robust sort of agricultural market. Well, what happens when some Arab farmers start saying, well, I'm not selling my produce to you anymore? The price goes up for produce. The kibbutzim, which are still selling produce, which are still making produce, all of a sudden they become more profitable. I mentioned that basically the Arab Higher Committee calls for a boycott of paying taxes. Another thing that they boycott, or another way of paying taxes, is through licensing fees. Well, now local Palestinians don't have a license to fish. They don't have a license to drive. They don't have a license to make tobacco or collect wood or so many other areas of the modern economy. Think about all the things that you have to apply for a license in order to do. All of a sudden in 1936, Palestinians can't do those things anymore. But Jews can. And so relatively quickly, as kind of holes are opened in the economy by the strike, Jews will come in and fill many of those positions. Again, we also want to kind of highlight this idea that the Arab, even though you have the Arab Higher Committee, even though you have a lot of the parties represented, there are a lot of Arabs on the street that just, they don't want to do this. They're not interested in a boycott. They don't think it's economically feasible. The cost is going to be too high for their families. I mentioned Haifa before. Haifa, the mayor of Haifa in this period, is an Arab. He has no desire to participate in the strike. We mentioned the Nashashibi clan. The Nashashibi clan, by October, so just a couple months after the Arab revolt has started, they want it to end. October is citrus season harvesting. What happens if we don't have the workers to harvest all the citrus? In the end, two things are worth noting about the effects of the strike. First, again, far from damaging the British or the Jews, the biggest victims of this resistance are Palestinians themselves. Rather than focusing on unity, Haj Amin is also kind of, again, engaged in this idea of consolidating his own power. His followers try to enforce his vision of the virtue of the strike against their own people. There is a tendency to inflame differences within the Palestinian community rather than kind of papering them over or smoothing them over or resolving them, which is what you really should do if you're going to engage in an insurrection or an insurgency. Second, it's also worth pointing out that even though you have the formation of the Arab Higher Committee, it is kind of created on an ad hoc basis. It doesn't have the kind of intentionality behind it as something like the Continental Congress here in the United States. And so basically, it is not capable of doing some of the bureaucratic work needed to sustain the revolution in ways that the Histadrut would in the mid-1940s, or the Viet Minh would after World War II, or the FLN in Algeria in the 1950s. A huge part of insurgency, or you could say counterinsurgency if you want to take it from that vantage point, but a huge part of an insurgency is having the funds to make the insurgency possible. You have to pay for all the propaganda materials, for the weapons, for bribes. Sometimes people are willing to sacrifice, but they say, well, I don't want to die if it leaves my wife a widow, my kids a widow. So the resistance movements need to set up structures to support widows, to support families, to support wounded. Where are you going to get this money from? You got to get it from the local population. In 1936, Palestinians do try to do this. But they just aren't very successful at it because it's incredibly hard to do. Consider that in the first 50 days of the strike, the Arab Higher Committee raises enough money to fund 2 days of the revolt. Just 2 days of the revolt. That's not enough. That's not enough to keep it going. Why is this? Well, there's a couple factors. One of the things that often used to happen, maybe not so much today, although maybe today, but certainly in the initial decades after the foundation of the State of Israel, there was a lot of Sturm und Drang from Arab states, the neighbors to Israel, saying, we are, you know, here for the Palestinians. We're going to resolve the Palestinian conflict. We're going to liberate our brothers and sisters. And then when you look at the sort of details behind the scenes, there's often a lot of not living up to those words. There's a lot of talk, not that much action. Now, they do receive donations from across the Arab world as the Arab revolt is going on. This does put Palestine on the map for a lot of Arabs living outside of that region. But these donations are just not enough. Now, another issue here is going to go back to this idea of how popular the revolt actually was and how much unity there actually was. There are a lot of Palestinians that are not interested in the revolt and they don't want to give their hard-earned money to it. You also have, unfortunately, some unscrupulous types who decide, hey, this is a good way to make money for myself. I'll go village to village. I'll say I'm collecting money on behalf of the Arab Higher Committee or on behalf of other Palestinian resistance organizations, and then I'll just keep that money myself. They actually have to develop something which they refer to. This is not my phrasing. They refer to them as jihad coupons. So basically, if you're legitimately collecting money for the Arab Higher Committee, you have a little coupon that you give to the person making the donation. Here, look, I'm legit. Here, you can tell because I've got this coupon. Now, at one point, the Palestinian nationalists do try to set up their own tax system to support their efforts, but this evokes hostility. Right? Times in the 1930s, it is still the Great Depression that is difficult in Israel or Palestine, as well as in other parts of the world. You don't really feel that interested in politics, and here come these guys with guns, and they come up and they say, hey, would you like to make a donation to the Arab revolt today? There are plenty of them that don't want to. There are plenty of them that don't feel that they can. They don't have the money to donate to something like that. And so again, instead of seeing unity and everything congealing together, as will kind of happen in the case of Israel after 1947-48, you have the opposite, right? There are fractures that are opening. There are tensions. Now, to move the story along, basically what happens is in the winter of 1936, the British begin to look for a political solution. And so they will create a commission to study the situation and make recommendations. How do we solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? The British basically convince the Arab Higher Committee, look, you can present your grievances to this neutral commission. They'll take your ideas into account. They'll think about you. They'll protect you. And we'll come up with a solution. On October 11th, 1936, after 7 months, the Arab Higher Committee agreed to officially end the strike in exchange for the formation of what becomes known as the Peel Commission, named after its chairman, Lord Robert Peel. For those of you that are fans of English history, you might recognize the name Peel. This, of course, was a very famous prime minister in the 1800s. Well, this happens to be that Lord Peel's grandson. As part of the deal, I mentioned that there is this limited amount of violence that also happens during the strike. There are some groups of sort of resistance fighters that form and try to mobilize. These groups, as part of the deal, are disbanded or forced into exile. One of these guys who was there on the scenes in 1936, but basically is forced to leave, a guy named Fawzi al-Kawukji, we'll talk about him more in just a few minutes. But basically, they all have to leave Palestine. So by this point, the region had suffered over 1,300 casualties, 197 Arabs, 80 Jews, and 28 Britons had died in the conflict. So this is a bigger scale than some of those limited riots that we've talked about, but this is also nothing like the kind of insurrection, the violence, the civil war that is coming in just a moment. At any rate, again, to kind of advance the narrative, on November 11th, 1936, the Peel Commission arrives in Palestine. Again, their job is to kind of investigate, think about it, come up with some kind of solution to the problem. Over the course of 2 months, it holds 30 public and 40 private hearings. These hearings include meeting with some of the most important leaders in the region. This includes people like Chaim Weizmann, people like David Ben-Gurion, who stressed that Jews do not hope to seize the majority for the future Palestinian state. They are prepared to accept some kind of legislative or political parity with the Arabs, regardless of which people actually happen to be in the majority. Now, David Ben-Gurion is an interesting figure. He is a talker. He is someone that the kind of, especially in the context of what is your future vision for Israel, sometimes he has a little bit more going on behind the scenes than what he professes publicly. So there are plans to create an independent Jewish homeland. Right? The idea seems here to be we're willing to compromise, we're willing to take something less than the whole, and maybe one day down the road we might get everything that we want. Ben-Gurion and Weizmann also advance a number of other arguments as to why there should be kind of binational state or an independent Jewish state in some sort of federation with the Arab state. They talk about this idea that Jews can invest economically in the Arab communities. They can kind of help them succeed economically. Reactions to the Peel Commission are somewhat mixed. On the Arab side, they had initially boycotted it until basically the Iraqi and Saudi governments convinced Haj Amin that testifying would be worth it. Haj Amin comes in and largely rejects those claims or those ideas that were advanced by the Zionists, including the idea that the Balfour Declaration means anything, that Jews deserved some kind of special homeland or some kind of special status to Haj Amin. They're always a minority, and they should be, and the land is Palestinian, and that's kind of it. Haj Amin also demanded immediate independence. He appealed to Wilsonian notions of self-determination. He appeals to some of that McMahon correspondence that the British had with Sharif Hussein during World War I that we talked about. Somewhat more ominously, as he's testifying, they start talking about, well, what's going to happen to the 400,000 Jews that currently reside in Palestine? Kind of like Ben-Gurion, Haj Amin is not going to come out and say what he actually wants just yet, but there is a kind of, well, you know, we can push it off to the future. He literally says, quote, we must leave all this to the future. And most likely that was because he wanted a large portion or a significant portion of those Jews to leave, especially those who had immigrated to Palestine in the 1920s and 30s. So it's in this tense environment that one of the commission members, a guy named Dr. Copeland, who is a colonial scholar from Oxford, he decides to kind of think outside the box. And he broaches for the first time the idea of a partition. To make a long story short, this idea of the partition, that we're going to give each group separate state, they can each do whatever they want in their areas, this idea wins out on the Peel Commission. The final report suggests limiting Jewish immigration to 12,000 people per year and a final division of land or partition between the two peoples. Jews would get the coastal plain and Galilee, and Arabs would get the rest of it, plus Transjordan. Jerusalem would actually remain a British colony, kind of an open city run by the British in this kind of formulation. In addition, obviously, once you start dividing territory, there are people that end up on the wrong side of the border. The Peel Commission thinks about this and makes the argument that basically where population and land ownership cross, those populations are going to need to be resettled to meet the new political reality. In essence, we are talking here about the birth of the two-state solution. Now, reactions to the partition are pretty mixed. The British government accepts the idea almost immediately, even if it leaves proponents on either side a little disappointed. For the Zionists, the idea of a partition is tempting. On the one hand, it marks the first real opportunity to form an actual independent Jewish state. Right? This is before the United Nations. This is before anyone has talked about splitting up the territory of Palestine. And so there's a kind of sense of, well, you know, are we actually going to get what we want? Are we just going to get autonomy? Are we going to become a kind of protected minority? You know, what happens here? This is the first time to really carve out an independent Jewish state in Palestine. At the same time, this Jewish state is going to be pretty small. And there are questions about whether or not it could actually be viable, given how small the size would be. Some of the Zionists, like Weizmann, therefore advocate exploring this option, pursuing it. Others, like Jabotinsky, who's more of a maximalist, we talked about him quite a bit in a previous episode, they reject it. Always the politician, Ben-Gurion kind of says, well, you know, maybe this is a starting point. Maybe we should accept it for the time being, and then maybe we can have some kind of union with the Arab state later, and Jews will be in the majority by that point. Ben-Gurion is, again, very crafty. He actually, after the report is issued, he goes and talks to the Mufti, and he offers the Mufti a political deal. He says, look, let's create a small Jewish state, something along the lines of what they're proposing. There'll be a kind of small Arab minority in it, too. And we'll join this Jewish state to a broader pan-Arab federation in the region. And that way, you know, Arabs can be convinced that the Arab minority is protected, that their rights are, you know, satisfied, that they're free to worship and, you know, celebrate their own identity. This range of opinions is also shared on the Palestinian side. I think a lot of times people focus on Haj Amin because he's, again, probably the most prominent speaker on behalf of the Palestinian people, at least in sort of appearance, if not in reality. Haj Amin, of course, rejects this completely and says, I want nothing to do with it. The Jews don't have any rights here. We should just have a free Palestine. His rivals, the Nashashibis, on the other hand, actually kind of liked it, at least privately. The portion of Palestine that would become an independent state would be united with Abdullah and Jordan, or at that time it was known as Transjordan. Well, that would be good. They would have their patron. He would be able to support them. And so even though they publicly repudiate it, under the surface, they're kind of for it. So again, we see this range of perspectives. We see this range of ideas. In the end, the Peel Commission doesn't really come to anything. But we'll talk about that in just a second. I just want to emphasize up to this point that most of the Arab revolt, like the First Intifada, for example, is mostly nonviolent. This anti-colonial resistance looks much more like something in India or the American South. And you have to wonder, had Palestinian national organizations been more successful in terms of their economic boycott, in terms of their strike, if they had been more effective at targeting colonial institutions, could they have had more success? Could they have driven the British out? Of course, as we've seen, they did not. And so by the time you get to 1937, the only path forward for anti-colonial resistance for many people living in the region seems to be the idea of violence. Now, already the potential for armed resistance existed before 1937. We've already talked about Al-Qassam and his followers. Another key player in the revolt was Fawzi al-Kawuqchi, a Lebanese-born World War I veteran who, at least according to the British, was the most effective Arab military leader during the 1930s in Palestine. Like al-Qassam, al-Kawuqchi had participated in the effort to create a greater Syria in 1920 under Faisal. He has considerable military experience. This is one of the most important things in trying to understand how kind of where we're going with this and how do we get there. Most Palestinians don't have a lot of military experience in the run-up to 1947-48. Many members of the Yishuv, the Jewish community, however, did have military experience. But let's finish the thought about Kawuqchi. Kawuqchi, in the aftermath of the putting down of the Syrian revolt in 1920, basically joins the new Franco-Syrian colonial army. He's made an officer. He's given military training at the French Military Academy of Saint-Cyr. Now, there will be a Syrian revolt as well in 1925, a large revolt. Kawuchi kind of deserts when that happens. When the revolt is crushed, he's kind of a man without a country. So he will be approached by Ibn Saud, who, if you remember, was the ruler of Saudi Arabia, had just taken over Saudi Arabia from Hussein. And so Ibn Saud brings him down to help train the Saudi Arabian army. When things break out in Palestine, however, Kawuchi will leave and come to Palestine at the end of August 1936. When he gets there, being someone with considerable military experience, he immediately begins drawing on it to elevate the resistance movement beyond simple guerrilla tactics. If you want to think about the armed resistance before Kawuchi in Palestine during the revolt, a lot of it is sporadic, spontaneous. It's a group of friends. It's a group of neighbors. There isn't really a strong organizational side to the armed resistance movement. And so Kawuchi tries to come in and kind of build this structure. This includes not only military formations. One of the things that he does, which is a military formation, most of the groups operating are small. We're talking about 4, 8, 12 platoon-sized units were kind of the biggest unit before Kawuchi. He expands this to a company size. He also works on the winning of hearts and minds. He will tour rural villages. He sets up intelligence networks to spy on the British. He begins a media campaign to complement the fighting group's activities. Even at one point manages to shoot down an RAF fighter plane. Now, another thing Kawuchi does is he sets up revolutionary tribunals to deal with Arabs or with Palestinians who don't support the rebellion. So, in other words, when you have these battles, the winning of hearts and minds, you don't just win by appealing to them and saying, hey, we're fighting for the nation and we're the good guys. We're trying to make everything better. You know, we don't like the imperialists. A lot of times these groups will employ violence against their own populations to try to discourage collaboration with the enemy. And Kawuchi is very effective in this regard. Of course, one of the advantages he has is that he's not from Palestine. He doesn't have kind of local allegiances. He's not seen as a partisan for any of the major clans. One wonders, had al-Kawuchi stayed, what could have happened? Would he have been the Ho Chi Minh of the Palestinian movement? Would he have been a Simon Bolivar or Che Guevara or a Fidel Castro? Unfortunately for the Palestinians, Kawuchi's time in the region was short-lived. In October 1936, as we noted, the Arab Hire Committee agreed to end the strike and with it agreed to disband those paramilitary formations that it had begun kind of building up. Kawuchi left for Jordan and eventually found himself in Iraq in 1941, where he would support a pro-Axis coup. We'll talk about him more in a later episode. He comes back in 1948 and plays a key role in the Arab-Israeli War of 1948. At any rate, to pick up our story again, in the summer of 1937, the Arab Hire Committee officially rejected the Peel Plan, and some members of the Palestinian Nationalist Movement began to turn their eyes towards the Axis, towards Nazi Germany and Fascist Italy, as potential allies to help them realize their goal of creating an independent Palestine. German and Italian propaganda efforts, mentioned at the beginning of our podcast, rapidly increased. And they even began sending weapons in small amounts to Palestinian nationalist groups in 1937 as part of the Arab Revolt. It was in this atmosphere that on September 26, 1937, a British district commissioner for Galilee, a guy named Lewis Andrews, was shot on his way to church in Nazareth. Now, Andrews was not just another colonial official. He is an open Zionist sympathizer. And his murder is meant to send a message to the British about continued efforts to create a Jewish home in Palestine. The British receive this as not just a sort of message, not just as a random act of violence, but sort of see it in many ways as a declaration of war. And so this assassination will launch what essentially becomes the second half of the Arab Revolt, the violent insurgency that tries to kind of kick the British out through the use of asymmetrical warfare. The British respond to this with, again, a much more extensive and brutal campaign known as pacification. Now, pacification is a strategy used to combat insurgency. It's the idea that basically you want to create carrots and sticks for local people to either support or to prevent them from opposing colonial governance. Now, to be specific, on one level, this meant the repression of Palestinian political groups and figures associated with the revolt. The Arab Higher Committee itself was banned after the assassination of Andrews, and Haj Amin was forced to flee the country. He first relocated to Lebanon, before moving on in 1941 to Iraq, where he would actually play an important role in this pro-Axis coup that I mentioned that Kawuchi was also involved in. Eventually, Haj Amin, as we'll talk about more in our next episode, actually made his way to Germany, where he sought out Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini as being potential patrons for an independent Palestinian state. Other Palestinian leaders were also arrested and sent to detention facilities in the Seychelles. The British also cracked down on Palestinian armed resistance groups, engaging in a series of firefights over the course of the next 2 years. Extensive efforts were made to root out rebels, using a variety of pressures to compel information from the local population. Again, this is something that you see in kind of counterinsurgencies. You always have people that are sort of villagers, they're suspects, right? The soldiers come. How do we know where the arms are? How do we know where the resistance fighters are? You see this time and time again, not only in fictional dramas about the Vietnam War, but in actual documentaries about it as well. It's a huge problem. How do you get the information out of the local population to get the guys who are leading the insurgency? Well, the British come up with a rather, I don't know if ingenious is the right word, but they come up with a tactic. And basically, they show up in a village, they order all the men to line up, and then they set out two tables. Now, at the first table, they check them for weapons, and then they ask the person what their name is. And so then they write the name down on a piece of paper, and then both the man and the paper are taken to the second table, where there's usually some kind of village elder, maybe an imam, if there's an imam there, maybe it's a group of elders, but basically the leading notables in the village are there. And this time, the soldiers ask the notable, what is this man's name? If the names matched and the man was not on a police list, then he can go sit down. But if the names do not match, then the person was taken to police headquarters for further interrogation. As you can probably imagine, these interrogations were quite brutal. They often involved the use of torture. Other British methods were also incredibly harsh, including the demolition of buildings. And this sometimes happened with people in the buildings, right? Shots were fired out of that building. Somebody was killed, and we know where the assassins fled from, or where the resistance fighters, if you prefer, fled from. Well, okay, fine. We're going to demolish that building. We're going to send a message to the local population. It's not enough to be a bystander. You have to help us root out these people that are engaged in insurrection. The British, who, by the way, pioneered the concentration camp, also set up internment camps in Palestine. They issue fines. They impose curfews. One of the big things that happens is, it's not quite an IED, but it's very similar. The idea that these resistance fighters are going to put mines or bombs or things like that into the ground and blow up trucks. So the British implement curfews in many places so that you can't do that at night when they can't see you doing it. The British will also confiscate property. They will, in certain cases, carry out targeted assassinations. And you also have cases where they shoot prisoners and then kind of explain it as being shot while trying to escape. Now, one of the most heinous things that the British do as part of this kind of pacification program is actually something very similar to what the Nazis did. They say, okay, you killed one of ours. We are going to kill not just one of yours, but six of yours. The idea being, it's not easy to say, okay, I'm going to risk my life, you know, to defend my nation, or, you know, to protest something, or I'm going to, you know, try to sabotage a train or something like that, right? To take my own life into my own hands is one thing, but to take other people's lives and risk their lives, that makes it a lot harder. In some POW camps, in some concentration camps, they say the penalty for trying to escape is not just that you might die, but that we're going to shoot the next five people next to you in line. Are you willing to risk the lives of someone that's not you? Another kind of brutal tactic. I mentioned the idea of IEDs, right? They're not really IEDs, but it's kind of in the same ballpark. How do we prevent people from mining roads and setting bombs for convoys? Let's just strap women and children to the front of the cars. You can find pictures of this online. The British will literally tie civilians to the front of the car so that you don't shoot at it, you don't try to bomb it. Human shields. Now, the rebels do have some successes, despite the way that I've kind of painted them very negatively so far. Especially in the summer of 1938, they actually managed to briefly capture the old city of Jerusalem. At one point, they cut the rail access to a town called Lida. They burn its airport. They're able to bomb the Mosul-Haifa oil pipeline. But for the most part, their attacks remain small and uncoordinated, more like the occasional ambush or act of violence or sabotage than something more sophisticated like what the Viet Cong or the FLN are able to carry out. In the end, a British troop surge in July of 1938 basically proves to be the difference. This breaks the back of the armed insurrection, and even though it'll go on for a little bit longer, the bulk of the violence, the high point of the violence, is kind of over. So unlike the Vietnam War, unlike Algeria, unlike a lot of these anti-colonial resistance movements where the resistance fighters, it takes a long time, there are a lot of casualties, enormous suffering, eventually, they're able to drive out the foreign imperialists or the colonizers. Indonesia under Sukarno would be another example of that after World War II. But in this case, the British are actually able to suppress the revolt and the insurrection. From a military standpoint, the losses experienced are far higher in terms of ratio on behalf of the Palestinian side or forces than it is by the British. Now, this isn't because the Palestinians aren't courageous, they're not skilled, they're not intelligent, but it's more a question of military experience, of training and equipment. Most of the Palestinian forces don't have military training. They haven't served in combat. Their weapons basically have to be bought on the black market, or later on, once they start getting supplies from Germany and Italy, the Germans are not sending their best material. The Germans are kind of sending the leftovers. You'll see complaints constantly about, you know, these bullets didn't fire, these guns jammed, right? So it's a lack of supplies, it's a lack of arms, it's kind of a lack of all of the above, really, in many ways. In the end, just to give you some figures, one historian has estimated that Palestinian forces lost 26 soldiers for every British soldier that they managed to kill. And this came to a total of about 5,000 Palestinian fighters killed over the course of 36 months. Now, at the same time, winning insurgencies is not just about repression and about killing the people that you're opposed to. It's also about winning hearts and minds. And the British are actually, despite the efforts of people like Haj Amin, they are able to do this somewhat effectively. One of the reasons why is that Haj Amin is not only sort of leading this anti-colonial resistance to the British. Haj Amin is also trying to secure his own power, is also carrying out his own kind of effort to consolidate his position among the various Palestinian factions. During the ceasefire period of June 1937, for example, which is when the Peel Commission, the report's being written, they're waiting to release it, one of Haj Amin's associates tries to assassinate one of his major political rivals from the Nashashibi family. The man's name is Fakhri Nashashibi. This happens in Jaffa. We can also turn to the words of Al-Kawukchi, who again was very capable on the battlefield. What did he think of Haj Amin? He noted at one point that Amin, quote, never fought on the battlefield of any country. He lays claim to leadership whenever he feels his life is threatened. Then he steals the money and retreats in defeat. End quote. Amazingly, despite this quote, Kawukchi and Amin would patch up their differences in Iraq in 1941, where again they both get involved in that coup that I mentioned. But the Mufti was not the only purveyor of Palestinian-on-Palestinian violence from this period. As we mentioned, one of the consequences of rebellions is the need to enforce loyalty to the rebellion, to discourage collaboration through examples of violence. You want to send a message. Don't fraternize with the enemy. Don't help the enemy. They aren't like us. We need to enforce this. In one of the most graphic cases, there was an Arab butcher in Haifa who was collaborating with Jews. What was he actually doing? He was a butcher. He went to buy some flour for something he was making. Well, he was not only killed, but he was chopped into pieces because he was seen as a collaborator. Again, the idea is to send messages not between the two communities, but within the Palestinian community itself about what is legitimate and what is illegitimate. As the rebellion begins to experience financial difficulties, the rebels need to find a way to finance what they're doing. How do they do this? Kind of talked about this a little bit in an earlier episode where we had some of the early Jewish kind of defense organizations. One of them got involved in bank robbing to kind of fund what they were doing. Well, oftentimes, in the name of anti-colonial resistance, these movements will actually kind of impose financial penalties or taxes or expropriation, however you want to describe it. But basically, you've got to take money from the local population in whose name you are carrying out the revolution. They create things like jihad taxes. You have people that are going to go around and literally collect money. And oh, by the way, they, again, are collecting money not just for charity. They're armed forces. So if I come and ask you for a donation, and oh, by the way, I've got my gun out. Is that asking for a donation? So sometimes you go to certain religious sites and they don't want to charge admission because that's kind of trying to make money and that's not okay. So they have required donations. A suggested donation from someone with a gun is not a suggested donation, right? Sometimes this is just pure robbery. You know, the fighters are resistance movements in some ways can devolve into gangs. Not that the gangs are trying to make money or become powerful, but they need to survive. And so how do you survive? Well, you steal. Another source of Palestinian and Palestinian violence is, again, this is all being done to a population living in the middle of the Great Depression. Times are tough. What happens after the British have fined you because maybe insurgents were operating in your area? And then the insurgents come along and they say, well, where's our money? We need to take something. And so you become a farmer that has nothing. You're on the verge of starvation. What do you do? Sometimes you got to steal from your neighbor. When it's all said and done, Palestinians, not the British, not the Jews, Palestinians killed somewhere between 1,000 and 4,500 Palestinians. Now, there's a wide range there, right? Those are various numbers that I've seen. But that's a lot of people. Palestinians are much better at killing other Palestinians than they are British soldiers or even Jews. We'll get to Jews in a second, right? Most of the insurrection, most of the Arab revolt is a fight between the British and the Arabs. The Jews we'll get to, in, as I said, in just a moment. What do we make of this aspect of it? And it's not just a particularly Palestinian thing. If you go back and look at especially the early history of the Vietnam War, the people that the Viet Cong are going after are not initially the American GIs that are there or even necessarily the Arvin. They're going after villagers. They're going after soft spots in their own population, trying to force people to pick a side. Algeria, another perfect example of this. If you look at the history of the Algerian War, the FLN kills thousands of Algerians because they were collaborating with the French or because they were rivals, because they had other ideas, other visions of what the independent Algeria was going to look like. This is a huge part of just the nature of these insurrections. there is a much, how do I say this? There is an important side of it that is the native group on the native group violence that often gets left out of the story because we either want to romanticize it or because we just don't see it because we're seeing all of the local people as being part of the same group. This Arab-on-Arab violence isn't just limited to the Arab revolt in 1936 to 39. It is, as we'll see, a huge part of the problem today. Hamas and Fatah, and to some extent Islamic Jihad, they don't all get along with each other. They don't like each other. They don't respect each other. And this makes it harder to speak with a unified voice. It makes it harder to achieve, I would argue, these kind of broader national goals. Opposition to the revolt within the Palestinian community was so strong by late 1937 that the British are actually able to find local Palestinian allies who they can often identify using Jewish intelligence sources as intermediaries. We just noted a few moments ago how some of Haj Amin's supporters had tried to assassinate Fakhri Nashashibi in 1937. As this wave of assassinations spread, the Nashashibi clan approached the Jewish agency, the Yishuv, and requested financial support for the formation of anti-Husseini defensive militia. They're described in the literature usually as peace gangs or peace bands. But it's basically the idea that, hey, can we get some money to form a Palestinian group to fight against the Palestinian resistance fighters? These peace bands, again, conduct operations against Palestinian rebels. Perhaps the most famous example of one of these guys who basically gets co-opted was the case of Fakhri Abd al-Hadi, a former colleague of al-Kawukchi's. By 1938, al-Hadi, who had been a part of the resistance movement, was broke and exiled to Damascus. The local British consul there, being kind of tipped off by some Jewish intelligence sources, decides to befriend him. Once he befriends him, once he kind of floats the idea of a return, once he kind of says, look, we British guys, we're not so bad. We can help you out with some things. British guy gets him on the British payroll. In September 1938, al-Hadi was offered amnesty to return to Palestine and the right to form his own armed gang or militia. They say, hey, why don't you go back to your hometown of Jenin? Which, by the way, just happens to be an area that we've had some trouble controlling local Palestinian groups. There's a lot of sympathy for the revolt in Jenin. Being a native to the area, knowing the people, knowing the relationships, the people, the families, al-Hadi comes back in and he's able to quickly pacify the area. In the short run, then, this search for and support of local allies proved decisive for breaking the insurgency. But it did come at a high cost. Not to the British necessarily, but again to the local Palestinian community who experienced these events more like a civil war. Again, I mentioned this figure at the start of our podcast. 30 to 40,000 Palestinians flee the country during the fighting. The fratricidal struggle between the Husseinis and the Nashashibis strips the Palestinian nationalist cause of alternative leaders who might have been more effective than the Mufti, than Haj Amin. One of these was Fakhri Nashashibi himself, who eventually does get assassinated in Baghdad in November 1941. Now, so far, we've spent most of this episode talking about Arabs and the British. But as we've seen, the Palestinian Jewish community were not bystanders. They don't just sit back and watch this play out and say, well, you know, maybe this will benefit us in the end. Instead, the Jewish leadership took an active role in supporting the Mandate government. This is an opportunity, they would argue. We work with the British. We show them how loyal we are. We show them how useful they are. They will reward us by fulfilling their promise to create a Jewish homeland. As we've already mentioned, economically, the withdrawal of large numbers of Arabs from the economy opens new spaces for Jewish labor, providing jobs and prosperity for the tens of thousands of new immigrants coming especially from Germany. Even in areas where the strike was effective, like Jaffa, The end result is not to harm the British, but it is to incentivize the construction of more reliable Jewish alternatives. This is how Tel Aviv, by the way, gets its deepwater port. And eventually, it surpasses Jaffa as a coastal economic hub. When Tel Aviv was founded, it was initially founded as a suburb of Jaffa. Today, Jaffa is largely a suburb of Tel Aviv. Why does this happen? A lot of it goes back to the Arab Revolt. Perhaps the most important place of continued Zionist development, though, was in the area of military affairs, where the costs of suppressing the uprising in terms of both treasure and soldiers led the British to rely more heavily on the Jewish community to do the work of policing. As early as the summer of 1936, when the rebellion is basically still an economic rebellion, it's going to put strain on the British authorities to pay for everything going on, Zionist authorities proposed the idea of hiring 3,000 gafirs, or auxiliary Jewish policemen, who will be responsible for guarding Jewish settlements and who will be paid for not by the mandate authorities, but by the Jewish community itself. For the British, this is great. We're going to free up some resources. We're going to not have to pay for any of it. This, you know, we'll be able to focus more clearly on our opposition, which in this case are the Palestinian nationalist movements or rebellious movements. For Zionists, for Jews, this means military training. This means access to higher quality weapons. Brilliantly, the Zionists, when they put forward these 3,000 policemen, they will all three of the 3,000 policemen will also happen to coincidentally be members of the Haganah. Again, this isn't so important for the revolt itself, but thinking about the future, now you have 3,000 Jewish policemen who have better weapons, better training than their Arab rivals, and this will play a key part in, again, the civil war that happens in 1947. Now, the high point of this military collaboration was the formation of so-called night squads, which were mixed groups of Jewish and British soldiers who took an aggressive or offensive approach towards the rebellion. We don't really have, like, the Green Berets or something like that in the British Army in Palestine in 1936-37, but if there was something like that, this would be the closest to it. These night squads are called night squads because they operate, shockingly, at night. They operate not just in a kind of defensive posture, but they will do things like set up ambushes. They will carry out targeted kind of killings. They are much, much more offensive than just kind of your basic soldiers. Now, the squads are led by a British captain named Ord Wingate, who is what some scholars today would refer to as a Christian Zionist. He is a Christian, but he sees the construction of a Jewish state as a kind of fulfillment of biblical prophecy, and so he therefore devotes his life, or promises to devote his life, to this cause of Zionism. This religious zeal is so strong that he actually, at one point, gets removed from Palestine because the British authorities think they can't trust him. He's too enraptured with the idea of the Zionist cause. Now, however he identified himself, Wingate's Christianity did not spill over too much into his moral approach, at least in terms of the insurgency. To combat the rebel formations, Wingate's night squads carried out their own brand of what we might call terrorism against the local Arab population. It's almost like, if you think about the movie Inglourious Basterds, right, the idea that there's this group of like American soldiers and they're going to terrorize German soldiers. It's not exactly what this is, but it's in the kind of realm of possibility. It's in the same kind of ballpark to some extent. To give you an example of what I'm talking about, after some attacks on the Mosul oil pipeline, for example, Wingate shoves oil-soaked rags into suspects' mouths until they vomit. Another trick to make villagers talk. You don't want to go through the whole two-table ceremony and, okay, you say people's names. Eventually, people catch on to that. They know what to say. Wingate will just have people running from a car until they get too tired. And if you get too tired running in front of the car, you're going to get run over. So at some point, you have to make a decision. I'm running out of energy. I can only run for so long. If I don't tell him the information he wants to know, I'm going to get run over and die. Another example from the village of Kufr. They basically line up all the adult men, and they begin executing every eighth adult male until the village turned over its cache of hidden weapons. Now, to be clear, in this particular example, at Kufr, the people doing the killing are British soldiers. Wingate did not allow the Jews in the squad to participate directly because obviously that might have inflamed the tensions between the two communities. But regardless, the effect is kind of still the same. So although the night squads were quite effective in military terms, killing quite a few of the Arab Revolt's local military commanders, their methods made them incredibly controversial, and they were phased out starting in 1939. Wingate himself would be transferred away from Palestine, as I mentioned, due to this unreliability, although he actually comes back to the region, at least to Ethiopia, in 1941 to help foment an insurgency against the Italian occupation of Ethiopia. Now think about that for a minute. The guy who was brutally trying to suppress the anti-colonial rebellion or insurrection in Palestine in 1936, 37, 38, that guy, just a couple years later, is now going to try to help lead an anti-colonial rebellion against the Italians, this time in Ethiopia. To make the entire story more complicated, he actually recruits some of his old Jewish night squad friends to come to Ethiopia to fight in World War II against the Italians. Wingate basically becomes very depressed. You can imagine he probably had some demons that he wrestled with. In 1942, he tries to kill himself because of depression. The British say, okay, we can't leave him here. They actually send him to Burma to organize resistance there against the Japanese, and he dies in an airplane crash in March of 1944. Today, Wingate is memorialized not only in London and in Israel, but also in Ethiopia, and his strategies are adopted by the Indonesians during their insurgency against the Dutch after World War II. So he is this crazy, Mel Gibson needs to play this role if they ever make this into a movie. He's this kind of crazy guy who is involved in all kinds of asymmetrical warfare, really very, again, just no hold barred fighting, global, transnational. What an amazing and interesting and fascinating and in some ways terrible character. Now, we should note that Jews are also on the receiving end of some of the violence during the Arab Revolt, but much, much less than their Arab counterparts. And obviously, there's no intracommunal fighting between various Jewish groups. The most spectacular example of Arab on Jewish violence during the revolt occurs in the town of Tiberias, where several dozen Arabs set fire to Jewish homes and to the local synagogue, killing 19, including 11 children. But this proved to be the exception due to the increasing prominence of the Haganah and other Jewish defense organizations. In fact, during the Arab revolt, as awful as it is for the Palestinian side, 55 new Jewish farm communities were actually founded during the 3 years of the revolt. Part of this is increasing Jewish prosperity. Part of it is really kind of ingenious. One of the things that they do is as soon as they buy the land and they decide they're going to build a settlement, you don't just go and start building the settlement kind of like, you know, if you think about shows like Little House on the Prairie, everybody comes and they spend a couple of days raising a house or a barn or something like that. That takes too long. You don't have any defenses. So what do the Jews do? They basically prefabricate an entire village, including a stockade and a watchtower, so that you go in at 6 a.m. in the morning, and by the time the sun goes down, you've already got a perimeter, you've already got a watchtower, you already have defenses against people who might be hostile to where you're moving in. Okay, let's transition now to talk about the end of the revolt. As the violence dragged on, the British government basically continues to search for a political solution to the conflict between Zionists and Palestinians. We already saw how the Peel Commission represented a kind of initial attempt to carry this out. To follow up on the Peel Commission, they sent the Woodhead Commission in late 1938 to kind of figure out, okay, what does this partition look like? We came up with the idea. What does it look like specifically? The Woodhead Commission, not as significant as Peel, so I'll just kind of summarize it very quickly. They do a couple months of interviews, and they come back and they say, you know, we really don't think this is a good idea. This doesn't really seem that practical to us. if you're going to do it, they do produce a kind of vision for what a future Jewish state might look like. It is extremely small, and the Zionists' reaction to the commission's reports are basically hostile. They don't like it. It's too small. It doesn't seem to be something that could survive. Arab reactions to it tend to be more sympathetic. They're more open to it. But in the end, it also gets rejected by the Arabs because to have any Jewish state is seen as wrong, right? Why would you take our country and give any portion of our country away? It doesn't matter how big it is. Any part of it is wrong. When the Woodhead Report is actually presented to Parliament, 2 days later, the government kind of issues its own, the British government, issues its own white paper kind of explaining what they're going to do, and they reject at this time the idea of partition altogether. Instead, they offer up the idea of a conference in London between the major parties, the Arab states, and they kind of threaten that, well, if you guys can't work it out at this conference, we'll just do whatever we think is best. This conference then proceeds in February 1939 as momentum in Europe builds towards war and the outbreak of World War II. The Zionist delegation was headed by the most prominent leaders of the movement, including Weizmann and Ben-Gurion, as well as Rabbi Stephen Wise of the United States. Major figures from the surrounding Arab states, such as Abdullah of Jordan, Prince Faisal of Saudi Arabia, who's different from the Prince Faisal of Iraq and Syria and Lawrence of Arabia, the different Prince Faisal. The Iraqi Prime Minister, Nuri al-Said, is there. The Palestinian delegation is headed by men who are loyal to the Mufti, but it does include two al-Nashashibis as well. Now, initially, there are some hopes for resolution to the conflict, but they founder over this basic question of immigration. The Arab delegation demands immediate independence and an end to Jewish immigration. There's already enough Jews here, right? The Jewish delegation, on the other hand, looking at this in 1939, Kristallnacht has just happened a couple months earlier. Jews are trying desperately to flee Germany. How can you cut off access to immigration at the most delicate, most important, most tender time? Jews in 1939 are desperate for a refuge. The British government's position in all this, by the way, is that they basically just want it all to go away. And they begin to realize the more that there's Jewish immigration into Palestine, the more upset the Arabs become, the more openings are created for Nazi foreign policy and to some extent Italian foreign policy to try to set up anti-colonial alliances. So the British, as they have often done, kind of go back and forth. This time they say, you know what, we need to assuage the local Arab population. We need to actually get Muslims and to some extent Christians from places like Egypt on board. That's really what matters to us. And so we're going to start to put a crackdown on Jewish immigration. In mid-March 1939, the government announces a new plan to limit Jewish immigration to 75,000 people over the course of 5 years, with land sales also prohibited. Now, again, to put that number into perspective, we talked about 200,000 to 300,000 Jews coming over a slightly longer period during the initial years of National Socialism. The British do demur on allowing Palestinian independence, thus preserving some ability of Jews to immigrate into Palestine. On May 17, 1939, these terms were announced as official government policy with the publication of the new white paper, with an additional statement that the goal was for Palestinian independence within 10 years. Reactions from Arab leaders were, again, mixed. Again, you kind of find people sort of tend to fall into the same line of thinking again and again. Abdullah is very close with the British. He sees this as very reasonable. There is a reconstituted Arab higher committee, and they reject it. Now, on the Jewish side, Zionists are outraged. And their interpretation of events, which is not surprising given the background context, is that Britain can no longer be seen as a partner in the building of a Jewish national home. Instead, the Jewish community of Palestine now needed to move together on its own, in its own sort of anti-colonial resistance to the British. On May 18th, the day after the white paper was announced, the Jewish agency organized mass demonstrations across the country, including some that actually turned violent. Behind the scenes, Ben-Gurion began to argue that, quote, the Jews should act as though they were the state in Palestine and should continue to act until there will be a Jewish state, end quote. Plans were made to foster illegal immigration into Palestine and to accelerate land purchases and settlement. The British, sensing this wider rift with the Yishuv, decided to disarm their erstwhile Haganah allies. A decision that, not surprisingly, increased efforts at clandestine Jewish armament. Plans were actually put into place to carry out a potential Jewish rebellion, the threat of which could be used as leverage against the British, who had no time for it in the run-up to war with Germany. In fact, the Irgun had actually launched their own bombing campaign against the British starting in 1939. In essence, you could argue that the Zionist movement looked at the White Paper of 1939 as a kind of declaration of war or as an abandonment of the Jewish community of Palestine. The Yishuv will move from a mindset of we need to work with imperial partners in order to create this possibility for a future to starting to say we will create that future ourselves. On the eve of World War II, therefore, British efforts to build an independent state and community in Palestine had failed completely. And far from keeping control of the territory, either directly or indirectly, they had to some extent alienated both groups, laying the seeds for two violent rebellions. The first, which we have discussed today, was led by Haj Amin and his more maximalist allies, with devastating consequences for Palestinian society. And while the revolt ultimately helped secure British concessions, the reversal on issues related to Jewish immigration and settlement opened up a second fundamental rupture between the Mandate authorities and the Zionist movement. Relations between the two would be temporarily patched up due to the threat of Nazi Germany in World War II, but in the post-war moment, Zionists were again no longer willing or prepared to work within the limits set by British colonial authorities. They would, in fact, launch their own anti-colonial struggle, culminating in the 1948 UN partition and eventually in civil war against their Arab neighbors. But all that is still to come. All right, that's our show for today. I'd like to thank you for listening. Next time on History Off the Page, we'll discuss the effects of World War II, highlighting in particular Nazi efforts to work with local Arabs to create a more widespread anti-colonial revolution. At the heart of this effort was Haj Amin, the Mufti of Jerusalem, who, as we have seen, was already probably the most influential Palestinian nationalist of the period. We'll see the effects of the war on the Zionist community as well, which once again tended to favor the buildup of Jewish institutions and military organizations. But again, all this will happen in our next episode. As always, if you liked our show, please subscribe or like or tell your friends about us. We don't really have much of a social media advertising budget or an advertising budget period. The way we gain circulation is basically through word of mouth. So if you find this episode useful, if you find it helpful in trying to understand what's going on in the region, please tell your friends about us. Give us a shout out on social media. We would really appreciate that. Again, you can also check out some of our other episodes on the origins of Ukraine, on Queen Elizabeth, the French Revolution, and many, many, many more episodes from European history. You can find more details about these on our website, www.historyoffthepage.com, or through the streaming service of your choice. That's all for now. Please join us next time as we take history off the page.